Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
A new book called Crying the News offers an in-depth history of America's newsboys in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. This workforce of children and teenagers sold newspapers on city streets, on moving trains, in frontier towns, and even on Civil War battlefields, and they helped to build the American newspaper industry. I'm Beth Harpaz, editor of a website at the City University of New York called SUM, sum.cuny.edu. And today I'm talking to Professor Vincent D. Girolamo, author of Crying the News, who teaches history at Baruch College. This podcast is hosted by the Gotham Center for New York City History in partnership with New Books Network. Welcome, Professor D. Girolamo.
Thank you.
Let's start with the logistics of being a newsboy. How did it work exactly? Why was it such a critical link between newspapers and the reading public? I'm thinking that a lot of our listeners grew up either buying a newspaper on the corner every day or having it delivered to their houses. We don't do that anymore now that we read newspapers online. But decades before home delivery and a newspaper box on every corner, there were these newsboys. So tell us, how did they do their jobs?
Right. Well, newsboys were essential to getting the paper from the press to the people, right? That doesn't happen automatically. And my book actually starts in the 1830s and goes to the 1930s. And throughout those decades, children were abundant in society, and they were particularly abundant in immigrant urban wards, and they were a labor source that the newspapers tapped. They did not have to pay them wages, so they could just rely on the boys to buy some papers at a cut rate, half price often, and then just hustle them as they would. So that was one method. Another method was to get carriers and to get adults and children did this work in various times and places. But the children would go to the newspaper office or a distribution depot and get their papers, to put up a few coins. They would get credit, and so they wouldn't have to have any startup money. And so from there, they would go to a certain corner that they had rights to, that they were accustomed to being at, or they would just circulate through the city. They do a combination of delivery and selling. And these areas, these routes, these corners, it became kind of not a black market, but a kind of an underground market, real estate market. These corners and these routes were bought and sold for hundreds of dollars.
Wow.
So it was often just within the newsboys themselves, among them. Sometimes in Baltimore, for example, the newspapers wanted to be on top of who operated that corner, who was in charge of that route. So there was a lot of variation from city to city, from state to state, but it was casual labor in that people would come and go.
Let's talk about the reality of what their lives were like, aside from, you know, in the pre-dawn hours, they're going to go to the printing plant or the newspaper office, pick the papers, and then go out and hustle them, market them, and literally cry out the news, right? Like, announce the headlines, sometimes embellish the headlines. And this was kind of a competitive thing where they're trying to sell more papers than, you know, a kid across the street or down the block or whatever. The kind of the fabric of the rest of their lives. I mean, so many of these kids were they were like as young as five, right? Mm-hmm. And there were thousands of them. What led them to become newsboys? What were their circumstances like? Where did they live? How did they live?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one boy named Johnny Morrow. He's unique in that he wrote a memoir in 1860 about growing up on the streets. And he said that hunger was the animating force of his trade. So you're trying to sell papers, you're trying to earn money for food. And so his parents, his father would send him out and rely on the customers to feed them, rely on his own earnings to feed them. So that dire want individually and among the family is really what drove newsboys, drove children to take up selling papers. And they would sell papers, but they would shine shoes, they would hustle, go after hats that were blown in the wind, they would shovel snow, they would do whatever was possible. So it was kind of a very kind of a mixed sort of labor. But newspapers were most reliable, and there were dozens of newspapers in some cities, and they had morning, they had afternoon, they had various editions, so you could usually find a newspaper that needed selling if you were a hungry kid.
Your book looks at newspapers all over the country. I mean, they were literally on Civil War battlefields. They were in Washington, D.C. They would board trains to sell papers. They went west with the westward migration into frontier towns. But, you know, we're here partly representing the Gotham Center for New York City History. So let's talk a little bit about newsboys in New York. In what ways were their lives different from newsboys in other places? I mean, New York's always been a media center. And, you know, we were obviously a huge center for immigrants. How did that affect the landscape for newsboys here?
Yes. Well, New York is really the birthplace of the American newsboy. There were children and adults who distributed papers in the colonial revolutionary period. Ben Franklin is one of the major examples. But this was a completely different sort of enterprise. So in 1833, with the birth of the penny press, the New York Sun, it becomes more accepted for kids to sell on the streets. And so New York really set the pace in terms of the number of penny newspapers. It soon spread to Baltimore, it soon spread to other cities. But New York was also a port of entry for immigrants. And so you see Irish dominating the ranks of the newsboys in the 1840s, 1850s. And you see with each wave of immigration in the 1880s and 90s, you start to get more Italians, more Jews. And so really it is an entry-level occupation, and so the newest comers sort of gravitate to the news trade, and in some ways push out the group that came before them. Mm. So it's connected to the immigration history of New York, and to its center as a media center, to its role there. What else? Just in terms of transportation and the railroads, and New York is also a mecca for other kids. So kids who are gravitating, who are searching for work, they come to New York, and this is a way when you're in a new city. Where do you go? You go to the news alley. You can get a armload of papers. You can get a steak. You can find out where to sleep, where to get a cheap meal. The newspapers themselves had restaurants, little cafes in their basements to keep these kids around and close. So when they had a new edition, when they had an extra, they would be in the vicinity. There was a lot of competition, as you mentioned, and so there other newspapers are vying for these kids. And they're also cooperating amongst themselves. I see stories of them pooling their money, defending each other. So as cutthroat as it could be, there is a lot of cooperation among these kids at certain times.
You mentioned that the newspapers in some cases had cafes for them, and they also created these homes for newsboys. One of the big themes of your book that really struck me was, you know, these kids helped build the American newspaper industry. And, you know, you talk about how the wave of reformers against child labor, the newspaper industry just fought tooth and nail to hang on to newsboys as an institution. Talk a little bit about that. And also let's talk a little bit about the newspapers actually created homes for newsboys mm-hmm. to kind of defend themselves against this criticism that they were exploiting these kids who lived in dire poverty. They were homeless. Yeah. They were hungry. They lived on the streets. They were vulnerable to child predators and other criminals. So let's talk about the newspaper's role here.
Right. Well, I show newspapers to be sort of pioneers of corporate welfare, of sports programs, of banquets, of excursions. There's also newsboy schools and night classes. They're doing all of these things to, again, keep the boys near at hand, but also to stave off criticism. And so they didn't really found the homes, although the New York Sun did give permission for a home to be instituted in its upper story, which they couldn't rent anyway because the presses would rock the building. and so it was the Children's Aid Society that started the first newsboy home in New York, 1854. And then it started several others. And then the Catholic Church, the YMCA, various individual groups in various cities would start newsboy homes, and the newspapers, the publishers would support them and would help endow them, but they weren't necessarily starting the homes themselves, but they were part and parcel. They were always close to the newspaper row or the location where the newspapers were. So these newspaper publishers and circulation managers, a new profession emerging in the late 19th century, they really did a lot to maintain these children's labor, their access to their labor, which was really unquestioned in the 1850s, 1870s. What the reformers did was to try to help them sell newspapers and help them get employment in that fashion. And that was the solution. Later in the progressive era, a newspaper selling is seen as the problem, not the solution. We have to get them off the streets. We have to put them in schools. And so that yesterday's solution is today's social problem. And so the newspapers are trying to navigate this transition, and they're defending themselves. What do you mean we're exploiting these kids? Look at all we're doing for them. And forget about our philanthropy. We are giving them employment. That is the best philanthropy anybody can do. How dare you criticize us? And that argument wins the day for a lot of years, but then around the 1890s, with the progressives, they start to say, "No, you know, you are exploiting them, and whatever pittance they make does not justify their not going to school. They're being ruined for disciplined labor, more stable labor," and so the newspapers defend themselves in print. They have editorials, they have cartoons, the advertisements that they run also show newsboys in a glowing light. So the self-made man image is not something that just arises because people look at that, oh yeah, these kids are really pulling themselves up, but it becomes something that's integral to their defense of their use of these children's labor. And then as we get into the 1930s, for example, there are laws that are trying to, child labor laws are being passed to try to limit the role of children in various industries. And the newspapers then take on the argument that, well, that's fine. Yes, we're for the abolition of child labor, but this is not child labor. This is a training, an education. This is a form of service. This is a public service that they're providing, and it's good for them. It's good for society. We couldn't afford to distribute papers if we had to do it another way. And so they are successful in winning exemptions from child labor laws, not just in defining it as not labor, but defining the children as not employees. They just buy from us and sell and keep their own hours and do what they want. So we're not exploiting them. We're not employing them. They're just independent merchants. And that argument lasts and lasts and lasts.
It's remarkable. And one of the most interesting threads in your book is how, this, you call it the Horatio Alger myth, right? And for people who don't know, you know, kind of the derivation of that, Horatio Alger was a novelist, and he wrote these rags to riches stories that, you know, really were about the American dream, right? Like a poor kid, you know, with all these terrible circumstances in his life, through hard work and determination, can become a great success story. And the newspapers, glommed onto that you know, that myth and aligned the newsboy story with that model, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that you kind of, you don't struggle with it in the book, but you give us both sides of, you got all these prison wardens saying, you know, these newsboys are the delinquents and the rogues out there. And, you know, 2 out of 3 people in my jail were newsboys. And then you've got the newspaper saying, well, but look at all these famous men who were newsboys. And you mentioned Ben Franklin. Tell us a few of the other famous names that, you know, started out as newsboys.
Oh, there are so many in the film industry. There's Frank Capra. There's Walt Disney.
Wow.
In politics, there's Al Smith, our own
governor
of New York, and Herbert Hoover as well. There is a Newsboys Hall of Fame that the Circulation Managers Association founded.
Wow.
I think in the 60s, 1960s, and they're trying to make this case. Entertainers as well, Jimmy Durante.
Wow.
A lot of these immigrant
kids. And I think a couple of my other favorites from your list, Harry Houdini, the famous magician, and Thomas Edison, the great inventor. But does this list really provide evidence that being a newsboy somehow put you on the road to success? Or is it just an indication of how ubiquitous this vocation was for boys and young men, you know, in this era?
Right. Well, I think it's mainly the latter. It is one of the most common, if not the most common, childhood occupation was to sell papers for however long. A lot of people did it. A lot of kids did it for a few weeks, a few months, and said, "There's nothing in this. I'm moving on." Yes. But you know, it was easy to trace somebody's who made good their background to being a newsboy, and so it was became part of their life story, became part of their obituary, and so it became a narrative sort of trope to you know, once was a newsboy. You know, they had that headline in many obituaries in the 1920s, you know, by the same token, I don't know if this is struggling with this idea, but children did work. Children did learn a certain amount of enterprise and try to seize their opportunities, try to hustle, have a good head for dollars and figures and developed kind of an acquisitive sort of operator kind of frame of mind where we need to make money. And so sometimes the news trade rewarded this, as well as having the physical prowess to defend your corner and to take on all comers. So I'm not saying that there's nothing to the story that kids can develop, that it affected their character, it affected their outlook, it might have even affected their success, but it becomes just this trope when you try to single out this one temporary childhood activity as the key to their success.
Right.
How does that only happens via Alger stories, via newspaper features, via kind of a media machine which is seizing upon that one aspect of their young lives to explain their success.
Right. And for the newspaper industry to kind of justify, you know, why this is a greater good for society that we have this vast workforce of children, you know, because it's good for them and it's good for all of us. And one of the, you know, you cite all these great stories that the newspaper industry itself did on the phenomenon of, you know, oh, let's look at all these famous men who were once newsboys. I think you and I had emailed about the book a little bit, and it brought to mind, you know, I'm a baby boomer, and in the 60s and 70s, every girl was a babysitter. You know, we babysat for $1 an hour when we were 12 years old. We might have had 4 kids that we were taking care of till 2 in the morning. No cell phones that you could reach the parents if there was an emergency. Mm-hmm. Looking at that with 21st century eyes, you know, those parents would be like, child welfare would be knocking on the door saying, what, are you kidding me? You left a 12-year-old in charge of 4 kids till 2 in the morning and you're paying her $1 an hour. But like probably every famous woman in America of a certain age was a babysitter. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that babysitting puts you on the road to success.
Right. My friend, colleague, Miriam Foreman Brunel wrote a book on babysitters, which addressed this very question. I think what I conclude is that there's a thin line between opportunity and exploitation.
Right.
And so we see these children walking that line. And man, some of them are just fall on the exploited side. And they not only lose their school years and their educations, but they lose their life. They lose their limbs.
Right.
They are vulnerable. Late at night, they're vulnerable, falling under the wheels of streetcars. So there are real dangers on the street, and so that is the reality as well.
Yeah. Another thing that you and I had talked about before we sat down to do the podcast was, you know, this is really your life's work. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, when did you come up with this idea and, you know, what kind of led you to this topic?
Mm-hmm. I think I came to this topic from a variety of sort of personal reasons and sort of scholarly questions that I wanted to answer. I had been a journalist, I'd worked for newspapers, and I had not seen the newspaper treated as an employer, as an industry that utilizes children's labor in particular. So I was interested in that. Also, my father and his brothers are all Depression era kids, and they hustled papers on the streets of Boston and Monterey, California. And so I grew up with their stories, and it seemed sort of romantic. It seemed sort of interesting. And they all became businessmen. They all opened little shops, a restaurant, a theater, and bar. And they were squarely part of the working class, yet they were not wage earners for most of their lives. And so I also wanted to look at the role of penny capitalism, of entrepreneurship within this working class milieu. If you all of a sudden, you know, become a small operator, do you therefore identify with the Andrew Carnegies and the big businessmen of society? Not really, especially when you or your family are wage earners and your customers are wage earners. So I wanted to look at the role of entrepreneurship in the working class. I think women's history and gender history was the most exciting thing when I was going to school. And so I wanted to look at also the sort of socialization of kids and how this masculine work culture develops. What was the experience of girls in the trade? What was their role in the family economy? These were the sorts of questions that the historians I was reading were asking about. And so I saw the newsboy as kind of a quintessential working class figure that I could get into these questions of gender, of family economy, masculinity, as well as the vices and the reality of living on the streets and hustling on the streets.
And this was actually your dissertation topic, right?
It was.
Wow.
So that was many years ago, and I did seven thematic chapters about black kids, about girls, about reform efforts. And so I moved across time wherever I could find the sources.
Yeah.
And there were huge gaps. And so when I went to the publishers, I go, it's not ready. It's not what I want. And I had to decide rather late in the game that chronology was my friend, that I had to tell the story of this archetypal occupational group over time. If it's this mythic figure, then it's their experiences that is the same no matter their ethnicity, no matter the period, no matter what. And that wasn't what I was finding. So I needed to look at the 1830s, look at the 50s, look at the Civil War era. My dissertation had, a paragraph or two on the Civil War. I found two scraps of information, and the book has a substantial chapter on
that.
That's
fascinating.
On the railroad boys, all of these things, and girls. I didn't do a chapter on girls.
Yeah,
I threaded the role of girls throughout the period. They pop up in the 1850s, and I really address them in a large degree in the 1890s. But they're a continuous part of the story.
Yeah.
So I was really involved a rethinking and a sort of a leap of faith on the part of my colleagues in the my department and in the college, and sort of allowing me to keep working at this.
Cool. And I feel like, you know, it's the beginning of a new school year. And this is, I think, very inspiring for, you know, people who are out there in academia and higher ed, you know, who have these ideas and, you know, just to inspire people to, you know, stick with it and you know, see it through to the end and see where it takes you, right?
I think so. I hope so. I remember Sean Wilentz at Princeton. He had this little line, goes, history is hard. A three-line sentence, but you know, in terms of just gathering the information, and of course, I did start before
you could Google everything.
Digitization,
yeah,
and so that allowed me to fill some gaps. You could have newspapers that were word searchable. I thought, oh, I have nothing on Chicago. That's the terrible thing. I have nothing on Los Angeles. I could really make this a national story, which started out as a New York story. New York figures in most all the chapters, but it becomes a national story because I was able to get evidence and documents from various places.
Right, right. Any final, I don't know, takeaways or any favorite stories about newsboys or anecdotes that, you know, that you love to tell or share?
Well, I guess one of the things that I developed when I was finding these little items was these funerals that the newsboys would bury each other.
They
would raise money to get flowers, to get a cart, to get the headstone. And so I just put those in a file. And I ended up having, I don't know, 24 examples of newsboy funerals.
Wow.
And so I did write an article on that. And it's not in the book as a set article, but I talk about their developing kind of occupational consciousness, their sense of respectability, their sense of themselves as part of a trade, not just, you know, beggars who are annoying people. And so one way you can see that, you can see what's in their mind, what kind of class consciousness they develop. They write letters to the editor. Johnny Morrow wrote a memoir. So they're written accounts. But in the rituals that they developed for each other, that you see also how they're asserting their pride of trade, their pride of class, and their fear of a potter's field, of being having an unrespectable ending to their lives. So that's in there too.
Yeah, that's a wonderful anecdote that kind of sums up a lot about who they saw themselves as, I think. All right. Well, I've been speaking with Vincent DiGirolamo, a professor of history at Baruch College, which is part of the City University of New York, about his new book, Crying the News, A History of America's Newsboys. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Thank you, Professor DiGirolamo.
Thank you.
And I'm Beth Harpaz, editor of the CUNY website, sum.cuny.edu, signing off for the Gotham Center for New York City History and New Books Network.